next session, number 23195, Grill 8.
Mr. Bolton, Reel 8. Now we're coming to the breakout from Normandy in August. What do you remember of this period?
Mostly, everything became rather more mobile. Staying in any one place tended to be a matter of 2 or 3 days, and then we'd be moving on again. It became apparent that the area was expanding, and we were beginning to hear rumours of a big offensive to break out. And then after that, we were simply involved in the succession of attacks, mainly with the Canadians at that point. The Canadian Army played a big part in the breakout. And we were approaching the time when the German 7th Army was pretty well cut off and got caught in the Falaise Gap. I think we began by quite a long march forward, following, trying to keep up with the Canadians. We moved forward with them. So they moved in the direction of Falaise. The war became...
How did that change your routine? Would your wirelesses be more important again then, in a more mobile role, or would they still be laying the wires?
Yes, I think it did. I think at that stage I got back onto the wireless set myself. I'd taken off the switchboard duty, which became less important anyway. Didn't have time to lay lines often. So it became very much a matter of moving regularly, quite long marches. And ultimately what happened was that we saw something of the fighting around the Falaise area that kept our guns very busy and kept us moving as well, in order to move first to support the 2nd Army, the British Army, and then the Canadian Army. We had a fresh sort of development in fire control, in that we had, for a time, we had an air spotting unit attached to us. So there was a little plane which used to fly around and call us back. For a time, we even had him on our own command net, our control net. That was quite exciting. On one occasion, I remember that the sail spotter was picked up some German artillery moving, retreating along a road, and called for fire to be brought down on it. And this happened fairly rarely when I was actually on the net myself, but it just happened more with the battery signals. But on this occasion, it was on the command net. So we followed him as he flew along the road above this German unit retreating, and gave fire orders, 400 yards left and 500 yards right and whatever. And finally said, "That's it, we've blown them all up." And I also mentioned about the horses galloping along the road, so we felt rather sad actually, we blew them up, because no doubt the horses got blown up too. And that was a sort of rather unusual graphic incident in our routine lives. Actually heard something going on like that.
And this is all done over the wireless, of course.
It was done on the radio, yes. Didn't happen very much. Communications were going by other nets or other ways. Right.
As you move forward, yeah. What sort of reception did you get from the French? Because we haven't really mentioned the French civilians yet.
That's right. In those early days, we didn't see very much of them. Occasionally, one of us, more adventurous spirit, would go out and find a little farm somewhere, and occasionally had a chance to try and barter our cigarettes or eggs and whatever. That did happen, but we saw very little on the whole of the French. I think at one place I remember there were two or three sort of peasant types appeared, and we gathered round, and I was called upon to translate. I had a position of some authority for a short time while we were in the beachhead, because I was the only one. And the signals unit had almost the only one who had a bit of French. Certainly, in my own group of operators, I was the only one. So I was called upon to translate, which I did very badly, I'm sure. Anyway, as we began to move forward, first of all, we found ourselves in a very nasty area, which was quite near to the sort of point where the Falaise Gap was due to close. We were working then with the Canadians. And I think we found ourselves with the Canadian units moving forward very rapidly to close the gap at one point. And all got a bit exciting. That was a change in routine. We spent a lot of time moving and not very much time in hastily prepared bivouacs. Then as we approached the... we got fairly near the Falaise Gap area, where the sort of killing ground was all going on. And one thing I mentioned at this point, which I should have mentioned earlier, the activity of the Royal Air Force grew and grew. And we used to watch them. This was already happening within a week or so of arriving. So they quickly changed their tactics to deal with German tanks and so on. But I think it became the most effective way of tank busting, actually, to use the Tempest fighters and whatever other planes they were using. And this we had a good clear view of always, because we'd see the planes high up above operating over the German side, circling round, picking up a target and diving down. Then we see the rockets leaving their planes with trails of smoke, and then see the planes go up again, and then we hear the crash of the rockets. That became quite a common sight. We hardly ever saw a German plane during daylight. Our own planes were very much in evidence, and were constantly attacking, I suppose, German armour, very effectively, we gathered them. Sometimes near enough that we feel the ground shaking when they were shooting off several rockets. And that was really a feature of the fighting for a long time. We used to see the rocket attacks being made by our own planes. That activity increased as we moved in towards the gap area. And also, as we moved along these roads, we began to find terrible wreckage everywhere. A lot of German wreckage too, German vehicles knocked out, smashed up. And generally speaking, with dust and shell holes and mess of fighting, more obvious. Until gradually the whole thing sort of became simply a pursuit, and the Germans were rapidly, finally gave up fighting. They fought very toughly, as we were well aware at the time, as we heard, with the Canadians. They had very tough fighting. Until finally the retreat out of Normandy began. And in fact, almost the next thing which happened to us was that all our lorries were taken off us by high command, all our three tonners and so on. We were parked in a field at a place called Yvetot, which is right outside the battle area.
How do you spell that? Sorry?
That's Y-V-E-T-O-T. Over the circumflex, Yvetot, which is just a small village. And we stopped in the field somewhere around there. Drivers were then given instructions to go and rendezvous at a certain point and take part in a vast refueling, resupplying exercise with the advanced troops. We're now moving at great speed across France and into Belgium.
This is into August, isn't it?
We're well into August, end of August now, into the beginning of September, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what were you doing back at Yvetot?
Nothing at all. We had a holiday. There was nothing at all to do. The vehicles had gone. The drivers were kept busy on the long haul. And that went on, I think, for perhaps 2 weeks. For us, there was nothing to do. We had little duties on maintaining equipment and checking goods and gear and so on, and cleaning up whatever vehicles we still had. And I don't know. Can't recall anything which happened there. It was all very boring, actually. I think we might have got out in the evening to some village nearby and got to a local pub or estaminet or whatever.
What were the estaminets like? Can you describe them? What was it like to visit a French estaminet?
It was quite all right. We enjoyed that when we could get away, and we did that whenever we could, actually.
Did they offer you? I mean, what would you eat and drink there?
Yes.
What sort of place were they?
There was very little left to drink. So they weren't, from that point of view, they weren't very good, because the Germans already had their share. They'd been there for years and they looted everything, and probably took a lot with them when they retired and they'd retreated. So the main drink we had was Calvados. We got to know what Calvados was, which is apple brandy, you know. It was a very potent drink, you know, colourless and strong.
Did that cause any problems?
I don't think so, really. I think we quickly realised just how powerful it was, and also it was quite expensive, really. And a little bit of pocket money didn't go very far. So I don't think we did any really serious drinking. I don't think we ever had the opportunity to get a little bit tight. I think we were under very strict instructions anyway now.
What about food? What would you eat? Was it still egg and chips? What?
I think food was so scarce that I don't think there was any in the estaminets and so on. Yeah. I don't think one could get any. My memory's a bit hazy now.
So it was just a matter of a couple of glasses of Calvados?
That's right, I think it was. And my bit of French, which I don't quite enjoy trying to use. And we were regarded... Actually, we were not always regarded, when we did meet the locals, we didn't always think much, and they weren't too happy about us.
How did that show itself?
They were a bit surly, they didn't really want to talk very much, unless they thought there was anything to be got from us, like cigarettes. I suppose we've been knocking their home about for weeks on end. And, not surprisingly, perhaps, they weren't too happy. It wasn't really until we got out of the beachhead area and when we got to this place, Yvetot, that we sort of established some sort of fairly normal relations with local people, insofar as we could get to see them, and we got down to the nearest town. So... But it remained the case, really, right through France, even into Belgium and so on. It was quite difficult to go into a pub or a stamina or whatever it was and enjoy oneself in a traditional manner, because always they told us the Germans have had it all. The Germans took all the brandy from Belgium. That was the story. And so they made their own to make up for it. We did have bad times occasionally through drinking too much. I don't want to go into that too much. I remember once in Belgium, it wasn't really our fault. I'm going ahead a bit now, but we got into a estaminet.
So you moved out of Yvetot into Belgium?
Yes, that's right.
What happened at the estaminet, Belgian estaminet?
We called for glasses of brandy, and some rather peculiar tasting stuff was given to us. We duly drank it. We began to feel very uneasy, very queasy, and also pretty tired and dizzy. In fact, it's quite clear this stuff was hooch. You know, they made it up themselves. So it's not genuine. And we met some Canadians there. And they joined in and had a little party. They were all for drinking the place dry and drinking as much as they could get their hands on. And they were also being well paid and very generous. And come on, lads. And so we got a great party going. And we kept on drinking this stuff and it kept on coming out. which on the whole is not characteristic. Certainly not of me. Although I joined in and got carried away by it. Not even my pals either. We all found it was heavy game, but we enjoyed it.
What was the hangover like?
Oh, terrible. We got turned out of this place eventually about 10 o'clock at night. Started to grope our way back home, quite a long way, of course, to get back, and have much ado finding our way. At some point, I think I fell into a gutter. I'm afraid this is being recorded for posterity, so it doesn't really amount to my pleasure at all. I fell in a gutter and cracked my head open. I got back to camp with a frightful bruise in my eye, which I couldn't conceal. I was subject to much leg pulling for some time thereafter. So it was a salutary lesson. We were very careful after that, I think.
After Yvetot, you were following up behind and moving into... You moved into Belgium.
That's right. Gradually moved up through Belgium, right up into Holland.
Still in the reserve, in a sense. Or were you moving back into the front line in Belgium?
Well, we were moving back to the front line by that. Once we left Yvetot, our lorries were finally surrendered back to us, came back to us. The proper supply line had been established, I suppose. And then we then moved slowly forward through northern France. We came up to the River Seine, which we crossed on the Bailey Bridge. Somewhere beyond there we began to catch up with the retreating Germans and did a little bit of firing here and there, and then moved right forward in through Belgium up to Brussels.
So anything happened as you moved into Belgium?
The main thing was, as you just reminded me just now, that we got riotous receptions wherever we went, crowds on the streets.
More so than in France? Then.
Much more so, yes.
Were the receptions like?
Crowds of people watching all the long, endless line of military vehicles going through, waving like mad and making nice remarks in French and little bits of English they'd learned, and cheers for Tommy and that kind of thing. They had flags and bunting sometimes and waved that. They tossed flowers into us occasionally and things to eat sometimes, better still. And we just thoroughly sat back and enjoyed it, and waving and feeling quite proud of ourselves, a bit swollen-headed.
It hadn't been anything like that in France. Not where
I don't really recall any. No, it certainly didn't come to my notice much.
Now, where were we heading in Belgium? Towards Brussels?
Yes, that's right. We made for Brussels. I don't know whether probably went round the bypass to Brussels, I imagine. Really recall there. Then we continued moving. On what turned out to be a sort of non-stop line of traffic and military vehicles moving forward, moving into Holland. There we did some firing, and we caught up with the retreating Germans, and did our usual routine of finding a field somewhere and surveying the guns in and running and getting firing again. Now, the curious thing is I don't remember a lot about this particular period. Things changed quite quickly, moved from place to place, and occasionally in action. Of course, moving like that meant that there wasn't a great deal to do with the communications. They were pretty static. It was once we arrived somewhere, got established, that we actually opened up our radio nets, which we ultimately did, and things slowed down a great deal as we began to come up to the big river obstacles in Holland, and we got back into a normal routine of fire support going on, forward observers calling up targets, and signals maintaining, setting up signal office, and dealing with communications generally, dispatch riders on their regular runs to the batteries, radio net open, linesmen out laying lines. And I forgot to mention one thing about the line laying. It's very, very difficult in action because they laid the lines usually off a winch on the back of a jeep. And of course, they sort of steered the line as it moved off the moving vehicle into the side of the road on the verge or into the ditch. They came to a road crossing, a crossroads, and they had to put up poles and take the wire off the ground and up and over the top and down the other side. But the bane of their lives was the heavy traffic. The lines continually got chewed up. If a tank got hold of your line, and chewed it up, tore it up. So the linesmen, having laid lines, spent the rest of their lives relaying them and repairing them. So I think our wireless communication became a bit more important because even the telephone lines were not always operative. So the sort of changes in the style of what we were doing. And always, as a last resort, were our dispatch riders. So if you do nothing else, you could call him in and sort of physically take a message from here from A to B. Mm-hmm. And there were always a lot of routine stuff which handled by the signal office, like daily casualty returns and strength returns, nominal rolls and reports, ration reports. And
would you deal with those routine reports?
Yes, usually in a fairly simple way. A lot of it went by dispatch rider, like say, giving it to the postman and taking them off. There's any more urgent stuff that we would deal with by telephone or radio. Mm-hmm. And the pattern did rather change.
So what's the next thing you remember? It's a bit of a blur, obviously.
It is a bit of a blur at this point, that's right.
Holland. Yes,
that's right, I have this just...
That's moving towards late October.
Yeah, that's right, yes. Yes. Really, after that, I just remember we got to a Dutch town called Tilburg. It was a fairly big town. And then we moved through there to perhaps a fairly short distance away. We were now into very flat, Dutch, marshy, wet land. And the time of year, of course, aggravated that. It began to get cold. And we arrived at a place called Oosterwijk. Now you're asking me. It's sort of O-I-J-E-S, W-I-J-D at the end, something. That's not quite right.
We're not quite sure. It's Oosterwijk, so O-I-S.
Yes, O-Y-S.
W-Y-R-C-K, something like that. But we don't know, really. And you moved into that area.
Now we're up very near the River Maas. First of the rivers, there were, I think, two or three great rivers which were flowing from Germany through Holland to the North Sea. And if I'm right, so the first one was the Maas. to them and stopped. So that finally, the whole advance finally came to us, stopping them on these big river barriers, and really for the winter we sort of closed down a bit.
At Oisteraig.
Yeah, that's right, at Oisteraig, nearby. A place called Seathogenbosch, where one of our batteries was situated, and that's sort of bigger than not in our local geography. The S being short for Saint. Seathogenbosch. I think that's about right.
And where were you? Were you at Oisteraig or Hurt?
Between the two, I think.
In that area?
Water everywhere, the local canal, I think, and eventually the river. The Germans dug in on the far side, we were on this side of it. We were a couple of hours away, probably. And there we settled down to a routine of regular firing on known targets, and making things uncomfortable for the Germans on the other side.
Now, what about the weather and the effect of the winter conditions on your lifestyle? So how bad was the weather?
It was cold, rainy, a fair bit. Everywhere was sort of wet and damp. It was very difficult. Even the big trenches, they tended to fill up with water quickly, so we didn't do very much. Life had also become rather quiet at that point. There was not a great deal of activity going on. Since I suppose we were shutting down for the winter.
How did you manage with your dugouts in the rain and the mud?
I think we slept. I think at that point we found a sort of farm place nearby, a farmhouse and barns and whatnot. I think we actually had the luxury of sleeping under cover now. There was a very little ray of shellfire. I don't recall any at all coming anywhere near us. We got very quiet. Just thinking, I missed out one. An important part of military life then, that was the Arnhem operation.
Of course, sorry, yeah. Well, I didn't realise you were involved in it. Tell me about that then.
We weren't directly involved in it. So we didn't really see much of the great air armadas and so on.
Well, I saw that later on when we crossed the Rhine. That was much more our business. But Arnhem wasn't. It just comes back to me. That was one of our big rush moves forward, and the whole island was trying to get up and rescue the survivors at Arnhem. And
of course we heard about that, and we saw a lot more air activity than usual, and we became aware that we were trying to get forward. And one medium regiment, not ours, but the other one actually got right forward to the point where they're actually on the spot, I think, helping the evacuation of troops across the river. We had news from them on two occasions, maybe not immediate, just probably a little bit further back, and we never got through the crash to get up to the firing point. So our was an exciting event, we were aware of it, and for two or three days we all held our breath, and as the news came through, we got rather a letdown when it obviously became the obvious, the whole thing had not been a success.
And that's when you went into the winter village, well, winter positions.
Yes. And the whole of the campaign slowed down. We found ourselves fairly comfortably in a sort of farmhouse place. A lot of straw, so we slept on straw at night. It was rather nice and kept us a bit warmer. But generally speaking, the days were cold and unpleasant and wet. And we didn't like it very much.
How did you get on with the Dutch civilians? Did you see much of them?
I think only occasionally. Not very much of them at all. No. They were very nice to us when we did meet them. They seemed to be able to speak English. Quite a number did. So we had been issued by the army, of course. As we moved along, we had a French phrase book, and then we got a Dutch phrase book. So we learned funny words like Alstublieft, which we all had, which meant please, I think. No doubt, Guten Tag or something, whatever you said when you greeted them. But the phrase books weren't of much use to us, nobody bothered with them. And the few Dutch we met then were quite nice. Later on, we saw rather more of them. Later on, we got a bit of leave even to go back into one of the Dutch towns. And
which one did you go back to?
I think it may have been Oisteraig, I think it was. was big enough to have a sort of little bee centre established there. So at some point I got, I think it was a 48-hour leave.
What would you do on your leave?
So one of our trucks drove us into the place, and we were billeted in some kind of large dormitory. Perhaps it was a school or a church premises, not quite sure. Which is quite nice. We've got proper beds and blankets and proper feeding arrangements, kind of restaurant, very good food. And the opportunity to go out and go around the cafes in the evening. That was fun. And it really was a genuine nice break.
Did you go with a special pal, or you know?
Yes, I did. Yes, I think with two of us, both fellow operator and me, were good friends.
What, do you remember his name?
Derek Houghton. Derek.
And what was it that made you pals with him?
Well, fellow operator. So we were closely with a group of about five or six of us who were operators, and we stayed together throughout the campaign. And then we shared the duties, we relieved each other, and came on and off duty. And so we just stayed together as a group, always. And we sat down, eat our meals, we'd be with the other operators. Yeah, it was all very informal, of course, and there was only 30 or 32 in the entire section, so I knew everybody pretty well.
But the wireless operators had a special need.
We were a little clique, as it were, a group. That's right, yes. Mm. They were mostly my sort of call-up vintage. Because think about call-up. Everybody got call-up early in the war, went off to the Middle East and became the Eighth Army and so on. And by the time they got to us in 1942, as we came up and reached the age of call-up age, we joined those who were sort of sub-generation who were due to go to the Second Front. So a lot of them were 20 years old. The average age, I think, of those was something like 23. But we had three or four older chaps among us and one or two older operators. So they tended to have their little group. We had our group of youngsters. And our behaviour was a bit less restrained and more riotous than theirs.